We will pause a few moments for silent prayer before beginning our class this evening, and it will give you the time, if necessary, for rebound and to shift gears into strict academic discipline. Shall we pray? Father, we're extremely grateful to you for the freedom that we exercise this evening. We are grateful for those in our nation's armed forces who have gone before us and are presently serving, and their exploits on behalf of this client nation have preserved our freedom for well over 2 1/3 centuries. And so we enjoy the free exercise of our religion because of the sacrifices that so many have made. And today we salute those who have served, and we're grateful for what they have done for this country. And it is our prayer that what they have done for us and for freedom will not be undone. And what we do here over the next couple of evenings, that what we note and examine will ensure within our souls the necessity that we continue to have the watchful eye of our armed forces protecting our shores and guarding our freedom. It is our prayer that what we look into now will motivate and encourage us and uplift our souls with regard to those who serve this country. And we lift our prayer in Christ's name. Amen. I'm personally, and I have to battle this, a little bit disgusted with this country. Not the people, not the real estate, but those who insist on using their power and influence to rob us systematically of our freedoms. It is an insult to those who have gone to war. It is an insult to those who have died on the battlefields of the world in defense of that freedom. And so as we observe Veterans Day today, I'm going to take you back in time and isolate one individual and show you the sacrifices that he made, the insults that he endured, but ultimately he was given and awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor. We're going to take a look at the saga of Roy Benavides. Client nation America, I think, is conflicted at the moment. Her prevailing attitude of ambivalence is reflected by constant mood swings, indicative of a collective bipolar disorder. Confusion breeds confusion, so that rational thought is replaced by a feel-good human viewpoint as the major problem-solving device. This malady is potentially terminal, short of a return to a biblical worldview. The weakness of a people is manifest by its unwillingness to protect itself. In the face of the glaring truth that we are engaged in a conflict with an enemy that grants no quarter, we cowardly explain the assassination of 12 soldiers with psychobabble from the current administration and the Army Chief of Staff. The Army knows of this man's religious views, just as Homeland Security knows that each day thousands of children are being schooled in the art of terrorism in Muslim madrasas. To transform the Fort Hood assassin into a victim rather than use the opportunity to fire a shot over Islam's bow indicates that those who lead this country are engaged in political expediency or suffer from the Stockholm Syndrome, the psychological tendency of a hostage to bond with or sympathize with his captors. Devotion to the dogma of political correctness becomes for the former only a rhetorical veil to conceal while advancing the hidden agenda of projecting blame away from self. For the latter, the incompetence of leadership to admit we are the victims of yet another terrorist attack, this time at the largest United States Army installation in the country. To add insult to this injury, the mourners of the fallen down in Texas were subjected to the insult of having their loved ones memorialized by men whose weaknesses contributed to their deaths. Religions have bad guys, and unfortunately Islam has its pesky rogues, drones the president. This is the price we pay for the higher calling of a diverse society, counsels the general. And the audience of survivors is forced by good manners to sit and listen to this drivel while dealing with the sorrow of personal loss. Now, since World War II, this nation has never entered into a conflict that its leaders intended to win. This has resulted in the crime of sending citizen soldiers into harm's way with no intent of achieving victory. The conflicts, occupations, and operations in Korea, Vietnam, Somalia, Iraq, Iran, and several other engagements have resulted in over 100,000 American killed in action with no significant impact on the preservation of our freedom. A nation possessing the best trained, best armed, and best motivated armed forces in world history that is reticent to achieve victory has a conflicted soul. Unless our freedom is threatened, this nation should not order its military into combat. If freedom is truly in jeopardy, then all measures should be taken to destroy that threat with undiminished violence, geared toward a quick conclusion and minimal loss of American lives. An example of those who have given the last full measure to their nation or incurred lifelong debilitating injuries while fighting her wars is Master Sergeant Roy P. Benavides, U.S. Army Special Forces Medal of Honor. His story is one of devotion to the West Point creed of duty, honor, country. His story is the subject of our Veterans Day salute to our nation's veterans and those who presently serve in the various branches of the armed forces. I will quote from two sources. First of all, Medal of Honor, One Man's Journey from Poverty and Prejudice by Roy P. Benavides and John R. Craig, and John R. Plaster's SOG, SOG, The Secret Wars of America's Commandos in Vietnam. First of all, we will note excerpts from the book Medal of Honor, which takes up the subject. It's actually a biography, autobiography, by Roy Benavides. And here's some of the things that he's written. And we'll build a case here because we'll start out with him as a youth and then move forward with many of the things that he endured, not only as a citizen of Texas, but also as a member of the United States Army. My given name at birth was Raul Perez Benavides, and I changed Raul to Roy when I joined the Army. The reason for that is when he was in boot camp, the DI would get in his face and call him Raul. He didn't like being called Raul, so he decided to change his name to Roy. He writes, "This is a story of the cost of freedom. It is the story of the American values that keep this nation a free democracy and of the people whose sacrifices must be remembered and relearned by each generation of Americans. I dedicate this book to the youth of this and future generations. My heart's desire is they never experience war, but they must be vigilant and prepared to pay any price for the preservation of their freedom. This is not a story about war. It's a story about freedom and its cost." Most people probably hear my name, Roy P. Benavides, and think that I'm a Mexican, or a Mexican-American, or a Hispanic, or a Chicano, or a dozen other names that I'd rather not mention. I call myself an American, but I, like every other Americans, I am American with a heritage. My heritage is Mexican and Yaqui Indian. My father, Salvador Benavides Jr., met my mother, Teresa Perez, at a dance held in an old wooden hall near the community of Ladeno. My mother was a Yaqui Indian. The Yaqui are about the toughest, meanest, and most ornery group of Indians that ever lived. Back when Cortez was conquering most of Mexico, he wisely chose to avoid the northern deserts where the wild men of the desert lived. The Yaqui had killed and eaten whole armies of Aztecs and Toltec who had been trying to conquer them for over 100 years. The Yaqui had their own system of clan government, and they engaged the Mexican government in warfare for 350 years. The Spanish, French, Mexican, and American armies were defeated time and time again when they set foot into the mountains and deserts inhabited by the Yaqui. Even the fierce Apache would not enter Yaqui territory. That, by the way, is in the district of Sonora, south of Arizona. The Yaqui don't recognize the border between the United States and Mexico, and both governments accept that. Yaqui lands and reservations cross that border at many places, and all Yaqui are considered dual nationals and are not required to observe the boundary, just as my impetuous parents refused to acknowledge some boundaries that had been set up for them. Maybe we should get the Yaqui to go to Afghanistan. They live out in that Sierra Madre area. My mother was born in Monclova, Cahuica. That's in northern Mexico, and it was still very wild at the time. Her people came into South Texas looking for land to farm alongside the land owned by the settlers of German descent who had come there when Texas was still a republic. My mother's people were done with the raiding and stealing and the killing. Because of my mother's background, the Benavides family's reaction to my father's announcement that he intended to marry my mother was severe. Grandfather Salvador was like many others who were designated Mexican, but in fact, his grandfather, Nicholas Benavides, had received a land grant of 1/4 league near Victoria, Texas in 1833. Nicholas Benavides' brother, Placido and Isidro, fought in the Texas Army in the War for Independence from Mexico, and Nicholas was loyal to the Texas cause. Records show that all of the brothers contributed horses, cattle, tobacco, rum, salt, and gunpowder to the Texan effort. My great-grandfather's brother, Placido, had been a captain in the Texas Army and had participated in the Siege of Bear under the command of General Stephen F. Austin, which inspired the Mexican General Antonio Lopez de Santa Anna to travel to San Antonio in Bear County and teach the Texans a lesson. The Battle of the Alamo ensued. In 1937, my brother, Regalio, was born. Now, that same year, my father died of tuberculosis, his disease contracted from the product of the seemingly harmless and generous creature, our milk cow. And when he lay on the deathbed, his sister, Isabel, was with us to help care for Regalio and me. My father was buried in a coffin made by a neighbor, and his body was transported in the back of a truck to the cemetery on the ranch where he had worked. My mother, left alone with two small children, had few choices. She moved to Cuero and took a job as a domestic worker. Cuero is on a branch of the Chisholm Trail, and cowboys had gathered the cattle there before the long drive north. The town's name is fitting, for Cuero in the Spanish is the Spanish word for leather or hide, and more appropriately, rawhide, where Cuero, Texas, is concerned. My mother was a beautiful woman. Looking at her photograph makes me understand why my father was willing to go against his family's wishes and marry her. She had big eyes, so dark that they seemed to have no pupils, and a mass of sleek hair. The doctor she had worked for did what he could for her, but she became increasingly ill. There was a state tuberculosis sanitarium in San Angelo, Texas, where some Anglos went to be treated for the disease. But if its services were available to people of our race, we didn't know it. The year I was 7, she died at home. Her funeral was simple. I barely remember the funeral service at Santa Guadalupe's church in the neighborhood where we lived, or the graveside service at the Cuero City Cemetery, where she was buried in a section reserved for people who didn't afford a plot. Perhaps I remember a little because I was so frightened. I had heard talk about what would be done with us. The most frightening of it to me, that Regalio and I might be going to different places to live. My stepfather's family was going to take Lupe, that's his half-sister, But it was clear from the first that they would not take my brother and me. We would be a burden wherever we went. I felt terribly alone. I was a 7-year-old half-breed orphan. And when the service ended, both Rogelio and I were taken in hand by a man I had seen only a few times. He told us that he was our Uncle Nicholas and that we would be going to live with him. Aunt Isabel tells me that our mother asked Uncle Nicholas to care for us after her death, that Rogelio and I were together was relief enough, and that after gathering our things, Uncle Nicholas took us to the bus station and bought us tickets to El Campo, Texas, relieved my fears greatly. By the time we were on the bus, I was almost happy. I'd never been on a bus before, and I'd certainly never been any place as far away as El Campo. I sat in my seat with my nose pressed against the window and watched the hills roll by and the countryside give way to flat fields. As we traveled, Uncle Nicholas told us a few things about our new home. Our grandfather, Salvador, lived there. He will tell you many stories, he said. Aunt Alexandria was Uncle Nicholas's wife, and they had 8 children, our cousins. What a deal, I thought. Just when I was feeling that I could hardly be more blessed, Uncle Nicholas looked down at my scuffled shoes, a piece of cardboard inside providing a patch for the hole in one sole. Tomorrow, we'll take you into town and buy you a pair of new shoes. And when we entered the house, my 8 cousins peered at us curiously from the other side of the room. A tall man gave Rogelio a hearty abrazo, a Mexican hug, and told us that he was our grandfather Salvador. "You must always remember that you are a Benavides," he said. "You must always bring honor to that name." Uncle Nicholas recited the cousins' names: Maria, Eugenio, Elida, Evita, Joaquin, Frank, Nicholas, and Miguel. They were now our brothers and sisters, he said. "We're not rich," Uncle Nicholas said, "but everything we have belongs as much to you as to anyone. We all work, and we share what we have. We will work alongside you, just as your new brothers and sisters do. They go to school and study hard. So must you," Grandfather Salvador said. "There are opportunities in this country for people who get an education." And just as I was beginning to feel that life in my new home might not be as idyllic as I had first thought, Rogelio and I were rescued by Aunt Alexandria, a woman with a kindly expression whose shoulders were already showing a hint of the stoop that she would have when she was older. "They're hungry," she said, and we were taken to the kitchen and given a generous supper of tacos. I got interested, and time has passed now, and we moved to the point where he is an adult. And I might tell you that interspersed within the book are several tales about how rowdy Benavides was. He loved to get into fights, and he claimed that he had a fight basically every day. I got interested in a program that had given me some education and additional income. Because of his circumstance, he had dropped out of school early. And could be worked around a steady job. He worked at a tire store. I'm familiar with that. I heard about the Texas National Guard, and the more I found out about it, the more I liked the idea. It seemed to be the perfect solution for someone in my position, and I signed up. My first taste of military life was basic training at Fort Knox, Kentucky. It reminded me of being back in the labor camps of my youth, only easier. I never could figure out what a lot of the other guys were complaining about. We ate good. Most nights we slept under a roof, only one to a bed, and we got a lot of exercise. The instructors, who were cadre or regular Army, got me really hooked on the Army. Before going into the National Guard, I was a typical teenage know-it-all. Once I met some of those instructors, I became more humble about my knowledge. They had been places and done things I'd only dreamed of. My fellow trainees taught me a few things, too. They came from a variety of backgrounds, and the astonishing thing was that we all worked together as a team. The experience was surprising to me, and it opened my eyes to the opportunities of a half-Mexican, half-Indian dropout from South Texas. When boot camp was over, I had made corporal. While I was in the guard, I got a chance to meet one of my heroes, Audie Murphy, the most decorated soldier from World War II. I had seen To Hell and Back, the movie of his life, about a dozen times when he came to Fort Hood near Killeen, Texas. I was already impressed, and when I actually met him, I was awestruck. But this time, I was nearly full grown and stood only 5'6" and weighed 130 pounds. Murphy was a little guy, as I was, but everybody was looking up to him. He had come from poverty just as I had. His family had been tenant farmers in North Texas, and he had picked cotton as I had. Yet he had made something of himself. He was a movie actor when I met him, and he was still a member of the 36th Infantry Division, Texas National Guard, a well-known and highly decorated unit during World War II. In spite of Murphy's celebrity, he was a polite guy who talked to us as if we were his buddies. Audie Murphy became my idol and my role model. I talked to some of the recruiters while I was in the Guard, and they encouraged me to go to Airborne. They filled my head with their views of the Army. Airborne is the elite. It is the best. It is for you. What do you want to do? You want to tell your grandkids about being a cook somewhere? Do you want to tell them about shuffling paper in Georgia? Kid, you're a fighter. You go airborne. You be a fighter. Well, once my mind was made up, I had to take one more essential step. I was old enough to enlist without my family's permission, as many young men did. But doing so would have been unthinkable to me. As wild as I was about some things, I would not have dreamed of taking such an important step without having Uncle Nicholas's permission. I was responsible to Uncle Nicholas, and he was responsible for me until I was 21. This was the old country custom and a basic rule of our family. If such loyalty existed today, our society might have fewer problems, but an abundance of men like Uncle Nicholas would be needed to command such respect. Raul, I believe that the Guard has done a lot to increase your confidence in yourself, and I think that it has begun to teach you a sense of responsibility. But I want you to be certain about this, if this is what you really want to do. Once you're in, there will be no getting out. I assured Uncle Nicholas that I was certain about the decision, and he gave me his blessing. "I'm very proud of you, Raul," he said. And I think his voice cracked slightly when he said it. To dilute the emotion that we both felt, he said as he left the room, "I'm not sure the Army knows what it's getting into." On the bus to Houston, I was a free 19-year-old, free of all my responsibilities, both to my family and to Mr. Haddock, who ran the tire store. I was sure that the year 1954 would be a big one for me. The recruiting station in Houston was a big building, the old U.S. Customs House at 701 San Jacinto Street. Thousands of young men had been processed there during World War II and the Korean War. On the first floor, there were offices and desks for all the branches of the service. Each recruiter competed to get enlistees to join up with the branch he represented. I walked across the floor like a cocky little rooster with all of my papers from the Guard and all of my records tucked under my arm. I walked straight to the Army desk. The sergeant took my papers and leaned back in the chair, and as if I wasn't even present, he started flipping through them. He was reading a little here and a little there, and every once in a while he would look up at me. And finally I just blurted out, louder than I meant to, "I want to go airborne." He started to smile, looked up for a second time, then turned his eyes back down to my papers and said, "Boy, I don't think you're big enough to do airborne." Jumping up, I leaned over the desk and stuck my fist in his face and yelled, "I can cut you down to my size quick enough." A crowd of recruiters gathered. The sergeant just laughed, and that made me one mad son of a gun. I had a Marine sergeant with an arm on one shoulder saying, "Son, I think Marines could use a man like you." I also had an army captain with his hand on my other shoulder telling the Marine to get lost. You're army all the way, son. We need tough guys like you. Those guys did a job on me. I was like a chicken that had walked into a pack of coyotes. Within a couple of hours, I had taken a test, passed a physical, been sworn into the army by an officer, and I was back on a bus to El Campo waiting to be reported. My last weekend in Germany, that doesn't seem like the right place to be. After 4 years of service and reenlistment, I had finally made it to airborne. The year was 1959, and time was moving on. Until I became airborne, I had often allowed my temper and my insecurities to control the direction of my life. Now I was a married man, and I wanted to fulfill my responsibilities to Layla. That's his wife. I was a sergeant with 4 years in and a career ahead of me. If I could really follow that motto of duty, honor, country, if I could keep it up, I felt I had a promising future. Uncle Nicholas had instilled several beliefs in his children, none more important than be the best in whatever you do, be the best. And he meant that to extend to chopping cotton, pulling beets, shining shoes, and fixing tires. I was determined to be the best. Being an airborne was my next step toward that goal, and I planned on being the best trooper they ever had go through jump school. Those of us who were airborne were trained to jump out of a plane or a helicopter. The first step toward that goal was to train at a tower. As any jumper knows, the easy part is the first 1,000 feet between him and the ground. The tough, dangerous part is the last 34 feet. Where he prepares to join Earth, in this case, the hard-packed red North Carolina dirt. Over 80% of the transfers out of airborne training occur between the first time on the tower and the second. It's that bad. Pretty soon, we all had our wings, and it was on to more schools after which we would be assigned. I felt proud that I was now one of the elite. I was airborne. The only unit more elite was Special Forces. They had been around since 1952, but they were still a very small and very specialized unit. I needed more experience in the airborne before I tried to make that step. I crisscrossed the United States from 1959 to 1965 while with the 82nd. In March of 65, I was given a six-month airborne recruiting assignment at Fort Ord, California. In October 65, I was assigned to Vietnam. American military personnel served only as advisors then. And before shipping out, I was given another round of training again at Fort Bragg. During that period, I was notified of Grandfather Salvador's death, but there was no possibility of my returning to El Campo for his funeral. I gave thanks that he had lived a long, full life, and I recalled his parables about having and helping people. Perhaps I was helping more where I was than I could in El Campo. Traitors, cowards, and crazies, the only few good fighters. If you could sort them out, that's how you divide the South Vietnamese troops. One of the craziest was Arvin Lieutenant Wag. Now, Army of the Republic of Vietnam, that's South Vietnam, and he was a lieutenant in that army. It turns out that the United States troops are there as advisors, and therefore when they're on an operation, the South Vietnamese officers were in charge. He said, I went on patrol with him only once. I would have killed him myself if I'd gotten the chance after that patrol, because I found out how crazy Wag was. Clarence LeChance and I were starting out on another patrol, and up walked Lieutenant Wag. Even Wag's own troops considered him a psycho. By mid-afternoon, we were walking into the village where we had recently lost a sniper, and Wag in the lead is in control. The place was almost empty. Most of the people were either still in the fields or hiding from us. We saw three villagers squatting about 100 feet away in the late afternoon shade of a hooch. Wag yelled at them to come over to us, and they sat there and ignored him. He pulled his .38 pistol and popped a couple of rounds at them, and they came running over with their hands in the air. Within a few minutes, Wag had the whole village, maybe 35 men, women, and children, bunched up in front of him. He kept screaming that they were all Viet Cong, and they were trying to kill his American friends. They just stood there with fear etched in their faces. Anything they said, anything they did, they knew were going to lose. Wag reached out and grabbed a woman from the back of the group. She was big, maybe 7-8 months pregnant. He hit her once and knocked her down. He started kicking her in the stomach. He kept screaming that she was Viet Cong whore and he was going to kill the baby before it was born so that it couldn't grow up to kill any more of his men. The guy was absolutely off his rocker. I looked at LaChance and he looked at me and we both knew there was nothing we could do. I started to reach for my knife. I could feel LaChance's hand on my arm. Wag was glancing back at us. One wrong move and I think he would have had his men open fire on us. This was Wag's country, his war, and his squad of men surrounding both us and the villagers. We were just observers. He got tired of kicking the pregnant woman and grabbed a man from the crowd. He was one of the three who had been squatting in the shade when he had come up. Wag pulled out his bayonet and started stabbing him. He stabbed him up and down the arms. And he kept yelling at him, demanding that he admit that he was a Viet Cong while he stabbed him in the chest and in the sides. The more he cut him, the crazier he got. That poor little pregnant woman was curled up on the ground moaning while Wag danced around her and over her, cutting and cutting. Chance and I, we just started backing out. We couldn't do anything to stop it, but we could get out. Finally, Wag left the bayonet sticking in the guy and grabbed for his pistol. He just stuck it up against the man's head and shot him. We saw the man's blood and brain spray the crowd. The look in the eyes of those villagers was chilling. Wag was doing the killing. Wag was the crazy one, but they were looking at us. American uniforms, American weapons, two big American soldiers standing by doing nothing to stop it. To those villagers, we were the ones doing the killing and the beating. They figured we were in charge and had ordered Wag to do it. You could see those suspicions in their eyes. I've killed a lot of men. I'm a soldier. Perhaps it's my job to kill. I've seen a lot of men die, too, blown to bits near me or bleeding to death in my arms. And with all I've seen, I will never forget the look in those villagers' eyes. The horrifying thing was that Wag wasn't the worst of them. Such evils weren't one-sided either. The South Vietnamese, the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong, they were all cut from the same cloth. We got that message loud and clear a short time later. Things were heating up in our sector in Second Corps, and refugees were starting to become a problem. Both sides had taken to destroying whole villages as retaliation for anything and everything. Those poor farmers had nowhere to go and nothing to eat. Down the road from the camp just outside Tom Key, the refugees had started to congregate and build temporary shelters. By this time, there were over 300 of them living there without roofs or latrines, just existing. My mind raced back to the picking fields in Texas and Colorado, back to my youth. We had lived well compared to the way those people were living. We talked about the situation among ourselves and with other advisors in the outlying camps. Finally, we did something about it. We scrounged around, as only U.S. Army troops could, and came up with enough material to build three barracks and some sanitation facilities for them. We were still feeling pretty proud of ourselves a couple of nights later when we heard all hell break loose down there. And as we raced out of our hooch, all we could see were our gunships laying down fire around the camp. About that time, all hell broke loose around us too. Two mortar rounds almost landed right on top of me. The latrine was one jump away and the only cover around. I stayed dry and took my chances above ground. Sniper fire was coming in pretty heavy. We knew it wasn't full-blown attack. It was just a little holding action while the Viet Cong butchered the refugee camp. They were making a point. Accept help from the Americans and see what's going to happen to you. LaChance, Lewis, and I made it over to the camp at first light. There wasn't an Arvin soldier in sight. That's South Vietnam soldiers. These were their people lying there butchered, and they could not have cared less. The people who were still alive were wandering around in a daze. We heard a wailing coming from around the corner of one of the barracks, and the captain rounded the corner first. I wish I'd never followed him around that corner. Three children were nailed to the barracks wall, nails through their little hands and nails through their tiny feet. They had been crucified 3 feet off the ground. The Viet Cong had used them for target practice, and they were pretty chewed up. All I could do was cross myself over and over again. I have never experienced so many conflicting emotions simultaneously before or since. There are no words known to man that can express my feelings at that moment in my life. An old man was kneeling below a little naked girl who had been crucified. His palms were turned up, and he was catching the drops of blood as they slowly dripped off her toe. My worst nightmares are the subconscious recollections of that father crying as he collected the child's lifeblood. We backed out of the camp without a word. Each one of us knew that if we hadn't tried to help those people, they would still be alive, and the villagers knew it too. I never could see one lick of difference between the people we were fighting for and the people we were fighting against. Only by being there could anyone really absorb the impact of what we witnessed. Civilized people don't do the things the Vietnamese did to each other. Even civilized warriors don't expect to witness such atrocities. God has taught us the value of each unique human life. Defending yourself, preventing criminal conduct, and fighting in declared wars are the only justifications for taking life. All other is murder. Compared to what had been done to the people we had tried to help, even Wag's actions seemed vaguely understandable. He was crazy. He acted alone. I could understand his actions as being similar to those of a guy who goes berserk and kills his family or shoots at cars going by. People go crazy. It happens. Society protects itself from those few misguided souls who don't value the single human life by locking them up or executing them. But seeing what the Viet Cong had done to their own countrymen, to the innocent children of their neighbors, made me realize that evil is real and that Satan is alive. That truth I bear witness to. The sight of those children crucified on that wall changed me forever. The stage had been set by American foreign... By the way, the reason I'm reading this, I'm building a case as we get up to the point where Benavides is engaged in a rescue mission, after which he was given the Medal of Honor. But I also wanted to show you how this man started out as a half-breed Mexican Indian, poor in South Texas, and an orphan at age 7. He was not educated, but he went into the National Guard, and from there he went into the Army, and from there he went into Airborne, and from there to Special Forces. It shows you that a man who loved to fight and would fight anybody, anytime, any day, was a troublemaker. He was a rowdy. He was constantly in trouble as a youth. But what happens when a young man of any background gets into the armed forces It can change his psyche, change his mental attitude, his outlook on life, and prepare him to be a winner. Because we don't have universal military training as we did during the Vietnam War, there's so many young men today that are losers and they will never know the difference because they don't have the order that could be given them in a boot camp and what follows. And so we're seeing the development of a man here over time as he sees atrocities in a country far, far away and events that took place there that were so convoluted, a disparate people in many, many different ways, but alike in many. And the way that stood out most for him is that they were simply inhuman. And we were over there trying to help them win a war against communists. Now, I'm not a military strategist, but we spent quite a number of years over there and we lost 58,000 men for nothing. Would it not have been better, rather than to battle the surrogates, to just go ahead and battle the origin of the problem, which at the time was Russia and China? We had the artillery, we had the weaponry, we had the bombs, and we had the machinery, but we're frightened of really taking on a real opponent. The stage had been set by American foreign policy years before that would necessitate my return, and that this is the second tour in Vietnam, and that of many other soldiers to Vietnam in January of 1968. Because since 1941, there had been two major wars in the region. Policy was dictating that the Pacific Rim would not under any circumstances be encumbered by communist domination. The military command for the area was known as the U.S. Pacific Command. It extended from the U.S. West Coast to Indochina and from the Arctic to the Antarctic. The United States Army Special Forces had begun playing a major role in the region in 1956. The need for unconventional warfare was thought to be needed in case any of the Pacific Rim nations were overrun and the immediate need arose to organize, train, and supervise indigenous populations as resistance movements. I was among those so trained for action in this enormous and complex world. I was proud to wear the Green Beret with my uniform. He's Special Forces now. I really believed, and I still do, in the West Point Creed, duty, honor, country. I thought that other people who saw my uniform should be proud too, not only of me, but of all the men and women who were serving their country. But Vietnam was a different war, not only in Asia, but in America as well. Eight other Special Forces soldiers were with me, and we were all heading for South Vietnam, where we would use the skills we had spent months learning at Fort Bragg. We landed in mid-January 1968 at the American Air Force Base in Cam Ranh Bay, where I would join a Special Forces team in the Vietnamese countryside. I didn't know what my assignment would be yet. That the war was very different from the one I had left only 2 years earlier came almost the second I stepped off the plane into the stifling Asian heat. Even some of the soldiers were different. On my first tour, they had been dedicated, professional soldiers determined to do their job. But the first men I saw when I got off the plane were young, and they didn't look anything like the soldiers I was used to. Gone were the short military haircuts. They had been replaced by long hair and sideburns on men who looked much younger than the men I served with on my first tour. These were just boys. They were mostly draftees who had no real military experience, but I was determined to have them look like professional soldiers. Fortunately, another Green Beret, a fellow Texan, felt the same as I did. Together we walked through the tents and issued orders for the long-haired men to get their manes shaved off and to do it fast. Most of them didn't protest too much. They at least knew better than to argue with two Green Berets. But at least one man argued too long and too loud. We lifted him off the ground and carried him like a baby to his sergeant. I told this soldier to cut his hair, I explained to the sergeant, and he damn well better do it. The sergeant agreed wholeheartedly, and the soldier got his hair cut. At the local NCO club, I got another opportunity to catch up on the changing war. The men always had news, and I found out that Special Forces men were being used for more than gathering information. Now I was told that Green Berets were being sent into combat. The casualties in the field were too high that the command needed men as fast as it could get them, and Special Forces men were also seeing action. I was told, too, that there was growing animosity between conventional warfare officers and Special Forces, which was resulting in Special Force intelligence reports being deep-sixed before reaching the right decision-makers. I became one of the Green Berets who was sent into combat to replenish the dying troops. My unit, B-56, was smack in the middle of it. They had been hit with a lot of casualties, and I made up my mind that B-56 was the unit I wanted to join. Of course, my buddies thought I was crazy. I really didn't want to go to B-56 to be a hero. I knew what it felt like to be an NVA target. That's North Vietnam Army. And I was just as afraid as everybody else. But I had friends in that unit, and besides, no Special Forces group was guaranteed safety. I figured I might as well be among friends. I had no idea what I was in for. Now, I want to go back and see if I can locate a particular excerpt that's in here that I didn't know if I would have time to relate to you. And I'll see if I can locate it, because we do have a few minutes, and I think you will enjoy this particular excerpt. It has to do with this fellow's rowdy nature. And he was bad to start fights, and so this has to do with one of those events. Isn't it crazy how you know where something is and you can't find it? Found it. Listen to this. This is, we can close out tonight. We want to get to the battle that ensued, in which he won the Medal of Honor. I want that for tomorrow night. But I think you will find this interesting and in how it reflects the integrity that this man had developed from his upbringing, from his uncles and his aunt. My last weekend in Germany, he was assigned to the Frankfurt area, actually Augsburg, in his early training. This goes back in his development as a soldier. My last weekend in Germany, I went out to celebrate with a couple of friends. We were walking out of a bar when we heard an argument in English going on at the curb. The two men who were arguing were in civilian dress, as were we, but we recognized the two at the club as a couple of new second lieutenants who were assigned to our unit. The most sober shavetail was trying to get the other one into a cab and back to the base. The intoxicated one wasn't having any of it. He was going back inside the bar to finish what he had started, whatever that was. My buddies wanted to get the heck out of there before the MPs showed up, but I figured we could give them a hand and settle it before it really became a bad situation. For once in my life, I was thinking about the people who depended upon me, the U.S. Army, and not myself. My friends lagged back, and I walked over and asked the most sober one if I could give him a hand. He said that he'd appreciate the help. But the drunk one said he didn't think that he ought to be getting manhandled by some little Mexican non-com so-and-so. One of my buddies yelled, "Deck him," and before I could think, I did it. He fell back into the cab, and the two men took off for the base. I was as mad at my buddies as I was at myself. I thought that if they had come over to help me, it never would have happened. What kind of friends did I have anyway? Were they looking to solve the problem or create one? Well, the next morning was Sunday, and I was in church early. Man, was I worried. I discussed it with a priest, and he told me that he thought I was making too much of the incident. I don't believe that he understood the situation fully. "Go in peace," he said. I wish that priest had been my commanding officer. Rank and discipline are the glue that holds the army together, and I had struck an officer in public with witnesses. There was a criminal offense involved, especially in the Berlin theater. If the army chose to make something of it, it would mean stockade time, prison, and a dishonorable discharge after I'd served my time. What a way to go home. What a way to win the heart of Lena. Layla. That's his fiancée at the time. Monday morning, I was sweating it out, but I didn't have long to wait. Word was passed on down that the top sergeant was looking for me. When I walked into his office, First Sergeant Charlie Turner turned, looked at me, shook his head, and told me to follow him. I tried to talk to him, but he wouldn't even look in my direction when he marched into the captain's office. The captain was a young man not too long out of West Point. He was a right-by-the-book kind of officer. Nobody knew him too well. I could only expect what I deserved, which was the worst. My file was in front of him. He would read a while, look up at me, then go back to reading. I was at ease in front of him, and I was sweating. Perspiration was dripping off of me. I could see my life going straight down the tubes. Would Layla be interested in me after I got out of prison? Would she even write to me once I was in Fort Leavenworth? I'd been making big plans for our future together, considering whether to remain in the military or get a civilian job. I had believed that I had earned a promising future and I was on my way toward it. Now I was one step from prison. The past 3 years had all been a sham. I was going to end up a bum, just like everybody else always figured I would. Corporal, you know why you're here. I understand there was a little trouble in town Saturday night. I've read your file, and you've been a pretty good soldier up till now. I see, too, that you're rotating home in a few days. I'm going to ask you something. Think before you answer me. Corporal, did you or did you not strike an officer Saturday night? Then he grew totally silent, folded his hands in front of him, and looked at me. Oh, man, that was it. The sergeant next to me was expecting me to just say, "No, sir," and march back out of there. The captain had offered me my life and my future back again, and he was sitting there expecting an answer. I just couldn't take the opportunity that I had been offered, no matter how much I desired to. All the time that I had been standing there knowing what I had done to my life, I had also been staring at a plaque on the wall behind the captain's desk. It read, "I do not lie, cheat, or steal, nor tolerate those that do. The Honor Code of West Point and Duty Honor Country," which was the West Point motto. All the time I had been standing there, I had been promising God that if I got out of this mess, I would declare my life to that code. Now here I was with a chance to lie my way out of it, and I just couldn't do it. "Yes, sir, I hit that officer." I said it fast, and then I couldn't take it back. The first sergeant looked at me as if I was crazy. The captain didn't say a word for what seemed like an hour, and then he ordered the two of us to get out into the hall. I figured the sergeant was there to keep track of me until the MPs came to get me. Boy, that sergeant was not at a loss for words then. He called me every name in the book. Mostly he called me stupid for not realizing what a chance the captain had given me. He was wrong. I knew it. I just couldn't lie and take it. And suddenly the door opened and I, Corporal Benavides, heard the captain say, "Sergeant, return the PFC to his duties." Neither the sergeant nor I could believe it. I lost a stripe. One lousy stripe was all I had lost. All he did was demote me from corporal to private first class. My life, my plans, my future, they were all still there. I could only thank God for guiding that captain while he decided my fate, and I swore that I would prove him right. Later that day, I was called back to the captain's office, and he said that he had overheard me using a lot of foul names to describe him after I had left his office earlier. I had been using some rough language, all right, but what I was doing was cussing out one of my buddies from the night of the incident that had got me into this trouble. The captain acted as if he thought I had been talking about him. He really knew how shaken up I still was and was just joking with me, but I didn't realize it at first. And finally, he put me at ease and asked me why I had answered him with the truth. It had stumped him, too. I told him about his plaque and how I do not lie, cheat, or steal, nor tolerate those that do, duty, honor, country, had made a sudden impression on me. I told him that someone I knew had been telling me the same thing in different words all my life. I told him I wanted a career in the military, and I couldn't base it on a lie. He stood up and shook my hand. He told me that I was the type of soldier they needed, and he told me to follow that advice and I would never go wrong. Maybe it seems a little hokey and a little dramatic, but that's the way it happened. And all of a sudden, I'd made up my mind that a military career was what I wanted, and that throughout it, I would honor Grandfather Salvador and Aunt Alexandria, Uncle Nicholas, Mr. Haddock, by matching my actions to the ideals of the West Point Code of Honor. Something had just snapped in me. That situation has stripped me right down to the bone and put me back together again as a soldier. Maybe it was more than that. Could it be that the West Point Code of Honor and motto that carried so many thousands of young officers to positions of greatness in the service of this country applied to a young enlisted man of no reputation as well? That code and motto burned themselves into my soul that day. We'll resume our saga of Benavides tomorrow evening. Heavenly Father, we do thank you for the privilege of gathering here this evening to take a look at a man who is a hero in our armed forces, who went out into harm's way and for over 6 hours was wounded 38 times. But never on one occasion did he flag. He continued to help his fellow soldiers to safety. This kind of attitude is not developed overnight. It takes training from parents. It takes involvement in organized systems of authority and submission to it. Orientation to authority is what is required for freedom to function properly. May we learn from this man's experiences as we recognize our veterans and salute them today for jobs well done on the battlefields of this world. We lift our prayer in Christ's name. Amen.